continue the public hearing on House Bill 2626, and we are fortunate to have Representative Brune here to testify today and appreciate you taking time out of revenue to be with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Scott Brune, State Representative, House District 37, which is primarily Tualatin and West Lynn. I am going to be very, very, very brief, and I know that's usually when people run and hide, because usually when people say you're going to be very, very brief and you have 15 minutes of oration that follows that. I do not, because I have spoken, I've spoken to this committee on this bill some weeks ago. I just want to say two things. One is, once again, to acknowledge the hard work that Chair, that you have done on this bill. She has literally burnt the midnight oil, and I mean literally burnt the midnight oil, because I have the occasion to run into her once in a while at a gym in Salem, and she has told me that I'm just, 6 hours earlier she's been.
Excuse me, Representative. Could I have a question?
Certainly.
Was there some type of filter on that burning that oil?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Help up for that one, Representative. We should warn you. Just don't talk about heavy metals.
Burning the midnight biofuel. Before I was derailed on that, she is really, 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 and I know the committee knows this, but I would state it for the committee, she has really done the hard work. And if every bill that we did down here had the hard work behind at least one representative that the chair has put into this bill, we'd be in a lot better shape. We'd have a lot less occasion to come back 2 years later and go, man, did we get it wrong on that one? We got to sort this out. So I just want to say thank you and acknowledge that hard work. And secondly, the point of that hard work, and my comments today are just that. She has, I think, with any bill, any comprehensive bill, any time we're looking at a major change in Oregon statute, there's lots of elements, there's lots of players, there's lots of people who have a direct interest. And the point to that is I think that she has addressed those issues through her hard work and her diligence on this to address most of those issues that did come up when any time there's comprehensive legislation. And to my way of thinking, she's addressed those in a good, solid, bipartisan way, and that's why I am, as I was several weeks ago, I am just happy to support this bill. I think this is the right step for Oregon. I think the issues from the manufacturing responsibilities, the landfill, all of the pertinent issues of this bill have been largely addressed and sorted out with these amendments. So, once again, I just wanted to voice my support of this bill and to thank you for your hard work.
Well, thank you, Representative, for being a co-sponsor on this, and I wish I could take all the credit, but first of all, my trusty co-chair here has done an amazing job with the work group, and then there is a room full of people here who
Absolutely.
Have been working with me for about 5 years on this effort, so I really appreciate it, and I thank you for signing on to the bill as a chief co-sponsor.
Thank you.
Any questions before we let Representative go back to revenue? Okay, thank you, Representative.
Get us some money.
Right.
Yes.
Get
some money. Okay, thank you. Next, I'd like to call up Lisa Dotto from Oregon Business Association. And actually, if you don't mind coming up together, just for the sake of time, and Michael Watson from the City of Portland.
My name is Lisa Adato. I'm from the Oregon Business Association, and I'm going to be even briefer than the previous brief person. And just I want to remind the committee that this bill, we applaud the work of the work group to come up with a fair and reasonable bill. The e-waste issue is one of the key priorities for the Oregon Business Association. We see it as a key part of our Oregon competitive strategy for sustainability, and we urge that you pass this bill, and we really appreciate the work that the committee has done on this very, very important issue, and I will end there.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Cannon, distinguished members of the committee, I've been asked today to come here and present testimony from Commissioner Dan Saltzman with the City of Portland, and if you don't mind, I would like to read that into the record. Dear Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, I would like to express my strong support for House Bill 2626. As the commissioner overseeing the city's Office of Sustainable Development, this legislation to establish a recycling program for electronic waste is consistent with our sustainable development goals and practices. Growing stockpiles of used and obsolete electronic equipment represent a significant waste disposal problem. Toxic materials used in their manufacture pose a serious risk to the environment if handled improperly. There is also value in recovering many of the components and embedded materials. While these items currently comprise a small portion of what is actually in the trash, rapid product redesign and innovation have increased the pace of obsolescence and the rate at which discarded items are piling up in basements and attics. A convenient and inexpensive option for reuse and recycling of these goods is essential to encourage consumers to dispose of their unwanted items responsibly. Eliminating the toxic components of our garbage is a priority for Portland. Last year, Portland City Council called for the preparation of a new solid waste management plan that will minimize the impact of harmful waste by targeting toxicity and that will pursue product stewardship policies as a means of achieving long-term sustainability in waste and recycling. The electronics recycling system outlined in this bill is an important mechanism for meeting these goals. It creates a free and convenient option for getting electronic waste out of the landfill and into environmentally sound recycling. It also clearly establishes responsibility among electronics manufacturers for providing end-of-life solutions for the products they design, produce, and sell. Establishing a landfill ban on electronic equipment is critical to the success of the proposed recycling system. Other multi-state regional efforts to develop model legislation have included this provision in recognition of the need for a comprehensive approach. House Bill 2626 would make the ban contingent on adequate collection, transportation, and processing capacity. This provides a welcome safeguard against premature restrictions and the risk of illegal disposal. For these reasons, I strongly support House Bill 2626 and the recycling system it would establish for electronic waste. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you.
That, I would be happy to accept any questions and or comments you have and forward them on to the commissioner.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much for coming today. Next, we have Wayne Reifer and Marcy Eastham. Again, calling you up together doesn't mean you represent the same viewpoint. It's just for the sake of moving along. Don't want anybody to assume anything. Ooh.
Hi there.
Make a dramatic.
I was going to say. Poor dog. Not good to kick dogs on the way to the time.
I can't even kick my own.
Why don't you go ahead and
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Marcy Eastham. I am a Northwest Regional Government Affairs Manager for Hewlett-Packard based out of Corvallis. And I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2626. And excuse me, particularly I'd like to express our appreciation to you, Representative Dingfelder, and to Vice Chair Cannon, and to the members of the work group that spent a considerable amount of time carefully weighing the many differing opinions on how this bill should look. And I believe we've developed a bill that will give Oregonians the opportunity to appropriately recycle their electronic products at the end of that product's useful life. That's one of the tenets that we've always held very close about these types of programs is we recognize the value of electronics when they're new, when they're passed on, when they're refurbished, but there comes a time when products simply cannot be used any longer. This bill allows Oregonians, as consumers, very small businesses, and nonprofits to have a way to get rid of those products when they simply can't be used any longer. It's manufacturer responsibility, which we have always held to be a cornerstone of how this should be working. And while we do have a few suggestions on some language revision and amendments that we believe will strengthen and ensure consistency in the legislation, we really applaud the work that has been conducted here, and we thank you for the opportunity to be a part of it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Would you go ahead, Wayne, and then we'll take questions for both of you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Reifer from Cedar Mill. I work with an organization called the Green Electronics Council, a nonprofit organization. And in particular, I heartily congratulate you and all the hard work that's been done on making this a success. I've been working this issue for many years now, and it's such a great pleasure that Oregon is one of the leadership states in passing, will be one of the leadership states in passing this legislation. I wish you the best of luck in moving it in this House and in the other. I have an amendment that am bringing to offer you today. It's a very friendly amendment. When I read the first paragraph of the bill, the section one of the findings, and then asked myself, how does this bill, in fact, accomplish that purpose of promoting environmental design of electronic products? And I came up with an answer, and that is what I am offering to you today. I manage a program called EPEAT, the Electronic Product Environmental Assessment Tool. About in 2001, I was managing a stakeholder dialogue here in Oregon called WEPSI that was with the electronics industry and environmental advocates and government and so on. And we asked them, we said, how could we create a design incentive based upon business practices, based upon market drivers that would help improve the environmental design of electronic products? And one of the members of that, a fellow named Ted Reichelt from Intel, said, what we really need is a standard, an environmental standard, so we can know a well-designed electronic product from an environmental perspective from one that isn't so well-designed. So that was the inception, and 4 years later, EPEAT came into existence. Proud to say it's an Oregon-grown program with broad national, in fact, international reach. It is an extreme success in the marketplace, well beyond our original expectations. All the major manufacturers have been supportive of EPEAT and have their products on EPEAT. And the particular point that was relevant is that in January, the president, President Bush, signed an executive order that required that 95% of federal government purchasing be according to this EPEAT standard. And that's easy to do because there's plenty of product to purchase from. So when I put those two things together, the phrase in your bill that I didn't see how it was really being realized, and this executive order from President Bush, I said, I think these two things go together well. And so that's what I have to you today. I've essentially borrowed the language. I've reviewed this language with the Department of Administrative Services, and they have gotten back to me. They are in support of this language, and just a few minutes ago they said to me that there would be no fiscal impact involved in this, so I can bring that language to today, and there may be others who would still want to weigh in, have some, you know, changes, that sort of thing, but I would offer it to you for consideration. I have some copies here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, are there any questions for the panel?
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you to both of you, and I'll be interested in seeing that amendment. Hopefully that will get to our proposed amendment. Hopefully that will get to our committee administrator. My question, Marcy, for you, first of all, thanks for HP's participation in the work group and ongoing support for electronics recycling generally and a statewide program in Oregon. I think that's just incredibly important to making this successful. Have you seen the amendments proposed by the television manufacturers, and if so, are you supportive?
I have seen the amendment, and actually we are neutral on it.
And just to follow up, so as far as how you read that amendment, it doesn't affect your operations?
That is correct. Okay,
just want to clarify for the record. Thank you.
Yes.
And I have a question for Mr. Reifer, but I want to see if anybody else has a question. So now that we all have the amendment in front of us, Wayne, can you explain what currently is the practice in the state of Oregon and how, if at all, this would affect our current practice? Because I do believe we are working under EPEAT now. Is that correct?
That's an excellent question, Madam Chairman. Indeed, that is the case, that the Department of Administrative Services, in fact, does include a requirement for EPEAT-registered products in their purchasing now, which is one of the reasons why it would not have a fiscal impact, and in fact there is no substantial greater cost for these environmentally preferable products. The purpose of it, of course, is to obviously extend beyond the current administration so that it becomes a good policy of the state of Oregon, being the primary purpose there, and reaching into parts of the state procurement that may not be, you know, captured immediately by the Department of Administrative Services. And one example would be the university purchasing and that sort of thing. The more that the marketplace says that we prefer environmentally preferable products, the more manufacturers will be producing them. And I must say, they are producing them. I know that for a fact. I see it on my website. My cohort here on the left, they produce some of the most environmentally preferable products in the market. And there's plenty of products out there that are very well designed from an environmental standpoint. And there are those that are not so well designed. And that's what we're trying to weed out.
Any other questions? Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the EPEAT certify, I guess, describe the range of electronic devices that EPEAT certifies? Are we talking just about computers, or does this include televisions, does it include cell phones, et cetera? What
Excellent
sort of universe
question.
Are we looking at?
Yes, EPEAT presently addresses only computers, that would be laptops and desktops and monitors. It does not address television sets or printers or other devices. We are presently engaged in a process. EPA has been providing funding and supporting of this all along, as well as now manufacturers' fees. We are presently engaged in a process to determine with everything is stakeholder-driven. Everything has to be agreed to by everybody of all the stakeholders. We are in a process to figure out what products would be next. It is fully intended, and there is strong support from industry and others to extend it to other product sets. It's likely that televisions will be involved, possibly printers, possibly servers, possibly, you know, cell phones and the like, and that will be happening over the next several months. And those, according to the language that is there written, and according to the President's executive order, when a new standard is developed, they would come under this. For new products, that would come under this. We'd have to develop a different standard for, you know, let's say printers might be have different environmental criteria than we have for computers.
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your support. I'm going to call it Mike Dewey and Julie Brandis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing Waste Management. Waste Management is, with regard to the solid waste industry in Oregon, is integrated in the sense that it does provide collection services. may actually operate in the metro region, the most trucks in the region. And we appreciate some other things this committee is doing in that particular area. We're in the transfer business, and we operate two Subtitle D landfills. And I came here to talk a little bit about the landfill ban, albeit we have some language, and my client has not yet seen that. Before I do that, though, I do want to thank the chair, who has worked indefatigably on this particular piece of legislation. We collaborated last session. It was a little bit different. We worked hard on it. And one of the reasons that we are supportive of moving in these types of approaches is we also process in other parts of the country where you can get economies of scale, electronic waste, electronic computers, and the like. Also want to thank Representative Cannon. I've said this privately to folks. He ran a very good work group. It was fair. People had an opportunity to say what they wanted to say, and we appreciate that. And then Mr. Danko's in the room, and he's worked very hard on this, albeit we've gone back and forth on the waste ban. Ora did a very good job of speaking to our concerns, notwithstanding the language that I have before me that we are not sure where we're going to be on. We just don't like disposal bans in the sense that the generator ought to be the individual that would be responsible, not the solid waste company or the disposal operator, albeit recognizing that if there's a refrigerator, it not be in the system and it ought to be taken out, and we would do that. Metro also enforces provisions in law, and so not only would DEQ have an opportunity to, if you will, find violations, but Metro has from time to time enforced based upon our DEQ permits. So they're another player in this market because they regulate the market with waste within that region. You know, I do want to say there will be times at a transfer station, at a landfill, notwithstanding the fact that we knowingly have a product that's sitting there. It may be crushed. It may be at the transfer station. And it really wouldn't make any sense to send it off to another facility where it's not going to be recovered in any way and then back to a landfill. So with that, Madam Chair, we will come back to you privately and let you know where we are in the amendment. DEQ, I think, has come a long ways with regard to trying to work this out, and we appreciate that. So with that, I will conclude. And if you have any questions, be happy to try and answer the questions.
Okay. We'll hear from Julie first, and then we'll take some questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. In terms of the accolades, I think I'd like to just share what I just had a meeting with the chairman of AOI, Ben Featherston, and he asked me to reflect on the legislature as he prepared for the executive committee, and I talked specifically about this work group. I said, you know, work groups can be kind of concerning because a lot of issues are discussed, and sometimes you neglect the ability to develop a legislative record on key issues when you participate in a work group. However, I think this work group, one, worked very well, and it produced a piece of legislation that I think is very fair and clearly in the right direction. And also, you've set it up in a way that we can reflect on the record, as we're going to do in a few minutes, on a critical piece to our retailers. So I appreciate both your work and Representative Cannon's work on this, and hopefully we can get some of these issues, remaining issues, resolved. The retailers nationwide have wanted to move to manufacturing responsibility. Obviously, this does this, makes that move. They have very few mandates in this legislation, and we're appreciative of that. One of the mandates in this legislation is that we shall provide information at the time of sale for a covered electronic device, and that is something that we really agreed to. It's not that you've heard me testify on this, I'm sure, in other committees. My favorite one was when we were going to have to do point-of-sale information on whipped cream. This is clearly, that was a few sessions ago. But
glad I missed that one.
This is clearly a different issue, and it's something that nationally they recognize that they have to provide information. It is the second shall that is still providing them some, or offering them some concern about what type of information they have to provide and how they do that. And we've been in discussions with Bob Danko from the DEQ, who has also done a great job and been really receptive to our concerns. And I think it's the second shall that's getting them concerned, because they still argue, despite my conversation, that it isn't clear. And just as an example, on Internet sales, it appears that we have to provide information at the time of sale and also when the product is mailed or shipped. And there's also different types of information that can be provided. And I think we may need to be able to seek some clarity on that. And I'll give you an example. In discussions we've talked about, the DEQ is willing to help us develop this list of information that's important to the consumer. There's a national website that's being developed called by the retailers who sell these types of products, called mygreenelectronics.org, and it'll be able to provide information to the consumers. They can type in their zip code and find out all the nearest and best places to recycle products. So retailers are really good at getting consumers information. I think we know that. And I think the second shall, I think we could work on a bit more. It's not a die-on-the-sword issue for us, but I certainly would like the opportunity to continue to work on that. The second issue of concern is the federal preemption section. I just mentioned it. I think because we're starting to see a patchwork of legislation nationwide, if we tried to make the federal preemption language look similar to other states' preemption language, that would be helpful. But I also recognize the proponents of a broader of the language that is in the bill wanted to make sure that there are certain things that are near and dear to Oregon about protecting our environment and making sure we have the best processes in the state. The third issue that caused our retailers some near heart attacks this morning as we walked through this legislation would be the penalty section. And I've learned 100% more than I knew this morning about DEQ's enforcement procedures and their civil penalties. But you can imagine if a retailer, a national retailer, is taking a look at this legislation and was reading it in Washington, D.C. this morning and saw that they could be subject to a $10,000 fine for failing to provide information to a consumer at the time of sale about what they could do with their product. That caused concern, and Bob Danko from the DEQ walked through me their Division 12 Enforcement and Procedures Civil Penalties, and I think what he plans to do at some point, whether it's today, is to submit those to the record. But initially what, and this is, again, I did not know any of this morning, and I'm sure he can walk through it later, but there are certain types of penalty that reach the $10,000 day threshold, and that is if you're doing something to greatly harm or provide hazard to the environment. Obviously, that is not the case when a retailer fails to provide information to a consumer. And so those would be more in the line of a different class of violation or penalty within the DEQ. So we wanted to make sure you knew that we were getting a better understanding of that and more comfortable with that section.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Mike and Julie?
If I may, I forgot again, Mike, do it for the record. ORA had a couple of other issues with some amendments that are in council, and we are supportive of those, similar to what you did on the biofuels in terms of the collection process and the franchise and, if you will, the sanctity of that. So we hope that will move forward. So I did want to make sure I put that on the record.
Okay. And just to clarify, Julie, that the clarifications that DEQ has provided are spelled out in administrative rule. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes, that is clear. I mean, it doesn't say specifically in their penalties that under this act, if, you know, a retailer fails to provide information, it's this type of penalty. But I think that the penalties in and of themselves define what classification the retailer would be under that circumstance. And I think it would be helpful for the legislative record, before this debate on this legislation ends, that the department walk through that so that there is an established record on that.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to call Dick Jones and John Charles. You can come up together. Whoever gets there first can get started.
Thank you, sir. My name is Dick Jones, Honorable Vice Chair Cannon, and members of the House Energy and Environment Committee. I found an issue that needs to be changed from your review of the House Bill 2626 in Section 2 under definitions in Subsection 2. The definition of a collector is as follows currently. Collector means an entity that collects covered electronic devices for the purpose of reuse or recycling and that meets the standards or contract requirements set forth by the Department of Environmental Quality. The balance of this act only talks about recycling, not reuse, except in Section 5, which speaks of the reuse of salvage materials back as a raw material into another product. In the recycling hierarchy, we always say reduce, reuse, recycle. This bill addresses the recycle part, and that's why I'm here. There's a section of the retailing industry that addresses the reuse of computers. That is the reason I came here today. These retailers, there are retailers who do sell pre-owned and used computers. The reuse of a computer really keeps the computer out of the subject of this bill. And we find that recycling hierarchy, reuse is preferred to recycling. I would suggest the deletion in section 2, subsection 2 of the words of reuse or, and this leaves the collector as the sole responsibility for recycling. One could add to section 2, subsection 12, for clarification, the following words that I have in bold and what I have written here. Quote, a retailer means a person who owns and operates a business that sells new and or pre-owned covered electronic devices to customers. My reason for raising this is just a person off the street, so to speak, is that for the last 30 years I've been a stockholder in the oldest locally owned and operated Apple reseller in the Pacific Northwest, Computer Stores Northwest, and we have an extensive market in the pre-owned Apple computer field. Our company was founded in Corvallis by a number of visionaries that included a number of people from OSU. Thank you for your time.
Before we go on to John, I want to ask a clarifying question. Are you referring to the House Bill 2626 as
yes.
printed or the amendments that have been proposed?
I've never seen any amendments.
Okay. I don't know whether the amendments address all of your concerns. However, it is likely that the committee will adopt the amendments, and perhaps our committee administrator can make sure that you get a copy of those amendments and be very interested in following up with you to see whether... I think he's got one now. So let's check in after the hearing and talk a little more about that.
I think that I have LC 3054.
Right, and that was the bill as printed, and we'll be considering and probably moving the Dash 2 amendments next week, which you now have in front of you. Again, there may still be some scope for improvement along the lines that you suggest. It was not the intention of those who developed this bill to exclude reuse from the program, and we've tried to build that into the program. So we should have that conversation.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to be here with a few and the proud of you still here on a Friday afternoon. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a market-oriented research policy nonprofit in Portland. And I'd like to just preface my remarks first by commenting about the work group process. And as someone who's lobbied here for a very long time, I'm not naive about how that happens. I have participated in dozens and dozens of work groups over the years, and they're great if your goal is to get the bill passed. But if you're a contrarian or you have problems fundamentally with what's going on, this is a problem that Julie Brandis sort of briefly referred to, which is you have this non-public, sometimes even off-site, process that goes on. And it's sort of artificial. It's an echo chamber of people who, to some degree, want the bill passed, but if you don't, well, you get to speak up when it finally becomes public, and at that point there's this momentum, and you can be seen as sort of dumping cold water on this, and I guess that's what I'm going to do today. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I think there are some issues based on my 40 years of both amateur and professional activism in this field that should be considered before you go down this path, and I'd like to call your attention to those things. One is that there's no need to rush to judgment here, because e-waste is an interesting policy challenge, but it is not in any sense a crisis. It's a very small fraction measured by weight or volume of solid waste at the municipal landfill. I mean, paper products continue to be the dominant, or wood products generally, element of municipal landfills, and they're eminently recyclable, but they still wind up as a large portion. And so this is something that everybody in the industry, whether nonprofits or manufacturers or retailers, they all understand this. They all understand there is value to be had. They're all scrambling to figure out what the best way to get it is, but it's not a crisis. Now, one of the lobbyists a couple days ago in supporting this, one of the work group members talked about this is a great chance to internalize the externality associated with waste. But, and I certainly, as a long-time environmental lobbyist, support internalizing negative externalities, but disposing of these products in a regulated landfill does not create an externality. The costs are fully incorporated into the price of disposal, and then some, in fact. Not only are anyone who is disposing of these at a landfill is paying the direct fee, there are a number of fees from DEQ. I mean, added on, there's an 81 cent per ton fee for solid waste processing that every landfill operator pays, 30 cents per ton for a permit compliance fee for the privilege of being regulated, 13 cents per ton for a recycling fee. Now, that's just from DEQ's standpoint. In Portland, of course, we like to do things bigger and better than anywhere else. So Metro is the regional regulator in that area. And for solid waste, the total Metro TIF fee is $69.86 per ton. Well, the disposal charge is only $46.20. There's a 50% markup that generators of solid waste pay for a slew of other programs that have nothing to do with solid waste. There's a $13 fee for the regional, it's called a regional system fee, that pays for a whole bunch of programs at Metro and the Solid Waste Office, exclusive of the actual disposal. There's a Metro excise tax of $8, contributes towards Metro general government, regional parks, and tourism development. There are DEQ fees, promotion fee, orphan site fund, collected on behalf of DEQ, $1.24. And then there's a community enhancement fee of 50 cents per ton, collected on behalf of communities that host the transfer stations. So the notion that generators of electronic waste are somehow free-riding, they're externalizing these costs to the public, I would say is exactly backwards of reality. That short of tobacco smokers, there are few subgroups of people who are used more as an ATM machine than solid waste generators. I think they're paying their fair share, and if you toss whatever it is into a landfill, and these are modern landfills. They're designed for all kinds of hazardous materials. They're monitored, and one externality potentially would be methane, but usually that's captured and turned into something valuable as an energy source. So there is no environmental externality. So the reason to regulate this is because it bothers some people that some things are wasted, not because it's like air pollution migrating from me to someone else and causing them harm. That is an externality. There is none here. it concerns me that the bill undercuts the principle of personal responsibility by creating yet another new free entitlement paid for by manufacturers. Now, because, of course, here the manufacturers pay and all of us get to go in for free, and that is a principal activity in this building is creating free things, or creating the illusion that things are free. And I sort of understand that. I mean, I still have my 1995 cell phone here, and I understand cell phones are not covered by this bill. But, you know, this was once a sleek good. And as a longtime recycler, I've never brought myself to just throw it away. So I still have it, along with my 32-inch TV screen that was blown out in a power surge, and other computer monitors, and I'm waiting for to be organized enough where I finally take them and dispose of them in a beneficial way. But the question is, this was by Motorola. Why would we charge a manufacturer 10 years ago for something? They just sold it to me, that's all. When I dispose of this, I am responsible, and I should pay the fee. And that's true of all these products. And waving a magic wand and pretending that the manufacturer is responsible and then everyone else gets to free ride, I think creates a very corrosive culture that's already bad enough, which is that, you know, we're victims. Someone else should do this for us because we're not mature enough to pay for this on our own. And this bill moves in the wrong direction. Manufacturers and retailers already have strong incentives to promote waste reduction and recycling as a profitable branding strategy, there are valuable elements in these products. And increasingly, people are going to see this as a way to capture and retain market share. And I think the last times that I have bought mattresses and refrigerators, it was right up front in the promotional discussion. We will take your old mattress. We will take your old refrigerator away. It's part of their strategy. Otherwise, I'm not going to do business. What am I going to do with another refrigerator? So companies like New Seasons Market, you go over there, clearly it's part of their strategy to provide lots of environmental amenities as a branding strategy. And Home Depot and Dell and all these other folks, they're all going to be scrambling in a very market-driven way to provide these services to get people in the door, take your products so they can sell you some more ones. And we should allow that to happen in the organic, iterative, messy way of markets that has been happening for essentially all of recorded history, that people have found a way to profit from someone else's waste. There's the unintended consequence problem of very complex bureaucratic schemes, as this bill is, and to regulation in general. And sometimes, if you ever had any extra time in the hearing, pursuing the sort of top 10 Hall of Fame horror stories of unintended consequences would be informative. But Reg 15 in California, which was related to it was the first mandatory commute trip reduction program, was a nightmare and eventually repealed. And even more on point to this, Portland's now 18-year-old polystyrene foam ban, in which if you go in a coffee shop or a restaurant, you can't get a foam to-go, a product in a foam to-go cup because they were outlawed by the Portland City Council. Well, in the last 18 years, the whole field of life cycle analysis has become rather mature. And almost every study, including the most comprehensive of a year ago from Franklin Associates, doing life cycle analysis of foam versus paper products, because paper is what you get now generally, shows that the unintended consequence was you have a significant increase in solid waste because you keep getting these double cups plus Java jackets, whether you ask for them or not, in most places in town, because paper is a terrible insulator, and we've now essentially mandated terrible insulation. You've created, from a life cycle perspective, more greenhouse gases, more energy consumed, and for most water and air pollution parameters, more water and air pollution. So it's popular to talk in sustainability circles, I mean, whatever that means, about the triple bottom line. And Portland's foam ban is essentially the quintuple move towards wastefulness. And it's an unintended consequence. It was Earl Blumenauer's primary idea when he was a city council member. But now that they have it, you can't get them to move off of it. Either they don't understand sustainability in Portland, or they just don't take it seriously, or more likely, they don't want to admit they made a mistake and they could just repeal it so we could do something more useful. And there are many other examples you could pursue about unintended consequences. I think adding to the list of items statutorily banned from landfills will worsen that problem, because when you ban things, that's when you actually promote the illegal disposal somewhere. And I think the list should be shortened, not lengthened. I think recycling needs to be, and I've known a lot of people in the business, and I've volunteered for a long time in the business, recycling needs to be nimble and market-driven to opportunistically find ways to make money from waste. And a key part of the sustainable definition needs to be, or definition of sustainability needs to be, positive cash flow. And a lot of people overlook that. Bureaucratic programs tend to be static and unresponsive, and in fact, the polystyrene foam ban is a classic example. Or go Google the Rural Electrification Administration, which served its purpose about 40 years ago, but continues to exist because, you know, you can't kill a bureaucracy. Markets are driven by actual opportunity, and that's the way we need to go in. So I'd like to wrap up just by saying that I was part of a work group that fortunately led to a bill being passed in 1983, Senate Bill 405, Oregon's Recycling Opportunity Act, that brought curbside recycling to most parts of the state. And I don't know exactly how the title was chosen. It was sort of a collective effort by all the legislators and stakeholders, but it was known as the Oregon's Recycling Opportunity Act, and it was deliberately chosen to give the image that we were not the recycling police, that this was going to be about opportunities to recycle conveniently at the curb in a market-driven way mostly, but that if you didn't want to participate, you were not going to be whacked across the head. And I think since then, others have felt that, well, it's time to kind of move beyond that, have bigger and better, be number one by some ranking across the country, and so we have to go to zero waste, and we have to mandate things. And I think that's environmentalism of the 1960s and 70s. I think that we should learn lessons of the modern-day movement that incentives work better than mandates, and we should try and use the market to our advantage and set up a framework that promotes that. And so I have a lot of concerns that as this moves forward, people will pay many, many large amounts of money to comply, and every dollar diverted into compliance is a dollar not spent on the actual goal of the bill. And companies have limited capital. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. You make some, I think, interesting and good points. One of the things that I'm interested in your testimony, you make the analogy between the foam versus paper cups in Portland, and suggest that the environmental consequences are greater, unintended though they may be, are greater and more harmful to the environment than the original foam container. And I guess just kind of a simple question. Do you have, or can you provide me the source of some data to clarify and substantiate that? I mean, I find this an interesting thought. And understand that I believe we do a lot of things in the name of good that frequently do have some significant unintended consequences, and sometimes those unintended consequences are for the better, sometimes they're not, for the better. And then,
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, we published a study in 1998 on this, and we are coming out next month with a revised and updated study with all the latest information, okay, which I'll be happy to provide to you. And in the context of that, we did interview people at Portland's Office of Sustainable Development and asked them if they were yet prepared to agree that this program should move on. And they continue to think this is a great thing, even though there is no empirical basis to support that.
Okay.
I'll provide you with our draft report.
That in your next, excuse me, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, may I follow up the question?
Follow up.
Just simply, will that be out in your next month's newsletter, or will there be access to it so that I can just go online and get it?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, it'll be published as a freestanding report and distributed widely and on our website, and I'll be happy to give you a copy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, I do want to thank Mr. Charles for his always provocative and contrarian view. And I also find it very interesting, and I would love to engage in this conversation for longer than we have today. But I will ask a single question.
I won't stop the two of you for going out in the hall if you'd like.
That would be fun. My single question is, isn't it your assumption, it is mine, that manufacturers will pass on some of the cost, or maybe all of the cost, that they incur to undertake the recycling that's required under this bill? So when you talk about the sort of challenge or cost to industry, that can be mitigated by the price of their products. Now, then it's a question of, do we as a body intend for the public to incur some of the cost? What is that? Do you have a different assumption about what manufacturers will do, given their increased responsibility under this law?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, that's true. There's no printing press in the basement printing off money. Someone will pay. But in that case, the cost would be split by one of three groups whom you never could actually define. One would be consumers in the form of higher prices. Another would be employees of that company in the form of lower wages. A third would be shareholders in the form of lower returns. And who actually pays is something you can't find out. Okay, but I personally am a big fan of user fees versus taxes or backdoor fees. And a user fee means to me the person who benefits from some service at that point in time pays directly. I think it's more fair. It's clearly more transparent. It has a better educational effect that there is actually a cost as opposed to all these backdoor mechanisms that sort of make us think things are free. And for the people, in this, in my view, in a scenario, people actually processing user fees, just like an entrepreneur, it provides a real-time market signal about what people are willing to pay, how much, where, when, and they can adjust their services. Backdoor hidden fees, because they're backdoor and hidden, they don't provide that kind of market signal. So I find them less attractive than direct pay at the pump or pay at the use fees from a policy standpoint. But you're certainly correct. They will be passed on to somebody.
Thanks. Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming here today.
Thanks.
Apologize for had to slip out. I was called to the principal's office. Okay. Next, we have Jim Craven, and Lorraine is back. What's your dog's name, Lorraine?
Ella.
Ella. Thank you for bringing Ella here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association that represents many of the folks that I guess are now known as manufacturers and maybe even a few that are now known as retailers. I'm not sure, but just a couple of quick points. One, I appreciate the clarification since the original informational hearing we had a month or so ago, the clarification of the definition of covered electronic devices in the bill. I think providing clarity to folks who will have to live with this for a while is helpful, and essentially clarifying that we're going to be essentially the same list of devices as Washington State will help manufacturers adjust at least to the new laws in the Northwest. I think at the original public information hearing, I also urged this committee to listen to the people that will have to make this work, and I do believe that that has happened. A lot of people in the work group are veterans of our interim task force from a couple years ago, and I do think that the chair and the vice chair have listened to those who are going to have to make this work, because that's where we're going to find out whether we're indeed doing the right thing. I understand this bill has a subsequent to Ways and Means, and so at that point we'll certainly be interested in just seeing the whole financial picture. I know it's intended to be other funds, basically self-funded by fees and registration fees, but I don't think to date we've really seen that big picture. We've seen if you're this size, you pay $15,000, but we will be interested, look forward to seeing that sort of bigger picture about the overall fiscal impact. I wanted to make a comment on, is Mr. Reifer still here? Yes, he is. Mr. Reifer showed me his amendment just during lunch hour down in the cafe today, and I just have a couple of comments on it. I don't have really a fixed opinion, but a couple of things. It does say an agency of the state of Oregon, when acquiring a new electronic product to meet its requirements, shall meet blah, 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 the requirements of EPEAT. I think perhaps friendly suggestion to conform this amendment to the bill, perhaps we'd want to say a new covered electronic device. It's fairly vague here what an electronic product is, and statutes that are vague tend to make people nervous. So that's just an idea that we conform this to the main intention of the bill. The other concern I have, and this hasn't been through the scrutiny of council, and they'll probably raise these issues too, saying that, I mean, this is a purchasing mandate, basically, on DAS, on the Department of Administrative Services, saying that 95% of the products they buy shall meet the requirements of the electronic product environmental assessment tool, registered electronic products. I think that needs more specificity or a tie to something real or some reference to something as it existed upon. I mean, this is a broad mandate to say that every device you purchase from henceforth shall meet a standard that currently exists in a certain form, but who knows tomorrow? I mean, I think Wayne's group has done a great job, and many of my members have worked with EPEAT, you know, to make sure their products are registered. But it is somewhat, I've been slapped down enough in council in the past, even referring to federal laws, to refer to something that one can point to. This, the way this is drafted, is refers to that standard at any point. I mean, if Wayne tomorrow said computers should be made out of popcorn, we'd have to conform. So I hope you get the drift. I'm not opposing the idea, but the idea of referring to some third party, a nonprofit organization that's not a part of the state of Oregon, to a standard as if it adopts at any future moment, I know will give people a little bit of pause. So maybe we can find a way to tighten that language either by reference to a date certain or something, as we usually do in statute. So those are just my quick reactions to this language, which I just saw a little bit ago. But I think people are going to want some more tied definition to something they know what it is than what it may be at any point in the future. So that's just my reaction, and we'll continue to work with Wayne on this. So thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take questions for both of you.
Okie dokie. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak. I've actually been asked to come back today by recipients of our donated computers and folks that work and learn job and social skills training in our recycling facility. I told them I was here on Wednesday, and they said, you have to go back and say it again. So, and they wanted me to make it a more personal story. So here I am. My name is Lorraine Kerwood. I am the founder and executive director of Next Step Recycling, an Oregon nonprofit electronics refurbishing and recycling facility. On the top of the paperwork I gave you, I have some definitions. One is reuse, to use again, especially after salvaging or special treatment or processing. To use something again, often for a different purpose and usually as an alternative to throwing it out. And then refurbish, to make clean, bright, or fresh again, or renovate. I'm offering these definitions to you for the proposed legislation. Throughout the document, the word reuse is referenced, but not defined. As this proposed legislation moves forward, I ask that the focus on reuse is emphasized and not ignored or forgotten, as has occurred in Washington, California, and Maine e-waste recycling legislation. I attended almost all of the Electronic Stewardship Task Force meetings. The importance of reuse technology for the greater good of our state was discussed often and with great passion. Our nonprofit exists to address the digital divide in our communities. The term digital divide describes the fact that the world can be divided into people who do and people who do not have access to and the capability to use modern information technology, such as computers and the internet. The digital divide exists between those in cities and those in rural areas, between the educated and the uneducated, between economic classes, and globally between the more and less industrial developed nations. I started Next Step out of my own need. I was a special ed kid who grew up believing I was too stupid to understand computers and how useful a computer could be to my life. After a car accident in 1999, I found myself unemployed and unemployable. I decided to go to college and see about a new career. I was terrified to learn that the university expected all students to know how to use a computer and, frankly, have one available to them. I decided to go to Lane Community College and see if I could learn how to use a computer. I took an adult education class that taught me how to turn on the computer, what a word processor is, and how to access the internet. I was shocked and extremely surprised that computers are actually very friendly to folks like me who have diagnoses of autism, mentally challenged, and developmentally delayed. After I got my first computer, the hard drive died and I tried to fix it myself. This led me to tearing computers apart and rebuilding them. By the time I was proficient at refurbishing, I was working as a child welfare worker. I met more and more folks who were like me, scared of computers, didn't have access to technology, but understood that having access to a computer could connect them to the wide world. Driven by the obvious need in our community to connect disenfranchised Oregonians with technology, I moved out of my mother-in-law's garage and started Next Step. Since 2000, Next Step volunteers and staff have refurbished 10,000 computers and connected thousands of community members to technology. We are dedicated to the incorporation of information technologies into the community in order to promote education and improve the quality of life. We give computers to persons who experience disabilities, children and adults living in foster care, family members leaving domestically violent relationships, migrant worker families, persons living in poverty, underfunded schools and nonprofits. We are one of 400 Microsoft-authorized refurbishers in the U.S. I have been hearing from other refurbishers that the e-waste laws in their states have had a harmful impact on their programs. Some California refurbishers are actually paying others to ship them monitors because available monitors are going straight to recyclers. I have heard reports of small nonprofit refurbishing programs closing their doors because they no longer have access to working technology. This is true in our community. Presently, we're the only gifting program that I'm aware of, and a couple years ago there was three or four of us. At Next Step, our mission is twofold: connect technology with those who do not have access, and to keep electronics out of our landfills. We believe reuse and recycling can coexist and meet the same objective of keeping electronics out of our landfills. We encourage you to consider some of the following facts. Manufacturing computers is material intensive. The total fossil fuels used to make one desktop computer weigh over 240 kilograms, some 10 times the weight of the computer itself. This is very high compared to many other goods. I'll skip over the next piece. Results indicate that refurbishing 1 in 10 computers reduces total energy use by 8.6% and 5.2% respectively by reducing demand for new machines. In contrast, recycling the material in 10 computers only saves 43% by replacing demand for virgin materials. The difference is dramatic and suggests the extension of lifespan should be should receive real attention on the policy agenda addressing end-of-life computers. Next Step Recycling wants to support a healthy economy that conserves the environment and ensures equitable access to living wage jobs. The connections between economy, community, and environment are evident, and I would urge you to consider the word reuse more fully in the document. Sorry, I started crying.
Thank you, Lorraine, for coming here today. Again, we really appreciate it and appreciate all the work that you've done, and not just setting up Next Step, but you were an integral part of the initial work group on this path that this legislation has taken. So we really appreciate that. And I think everybody involved in this really truly appreciates the work of nonprofits. I know we have another nonprofit here today, Free Geek, which is where I send my computers to get recycled mm-hmm. and reused. And the intent, I know, of the work group and certainly legislators who have worked on this is to support organizations such as yourselves. And we've made that pretty clear in the legislation that we want to especially try to support the existing infrastructure as much as we can and help reimburse you for many of the costs that you now pay for with volunteers. So you don't get reimbursement for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we really appreciate you coming here because you're an important part of this whole life cycle on computers. Any questions for either of the panelists? And Jim, I'm going to ask you, you're going to work with Wayne on that amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. Jim Craven for the record. It is a brand new thing that we haven't seen. It seems to be acceptable, but I guess I need to reserve a little bit of room on that to learn a little bit more about who is a registered EPEAT product and what kind of barrier to bidding on a state contract this would represent.
Just a quick question, though. My understanding when Mr. Reifer came up was that this is a process that is already in place. It's a policy that's already in place through Department of Administrative Services.
Madam Chair, if that's the case, I did hear him say that, and I think I heard him say that, well, why is it even necessary? Well, because what if there's a change in administration? So I understand that. I do just to say one more time, putting a barrier to entry to sell a product to the state of Oregon that isn't labeled by a third-party nonprofit group for a standard that is open-ended is, it's just a little troublesome, totally well-intended, but, and maybe we can work to, you know, as it existed on, or some kind of standard that people would, if they read this legislation a year from now, or somebody's going to enforce this, that it's connected to not just whatever EPEAT would like to do at some future point, that they know we're adopting to some kind of standard that they can look up and mm-hmm. and know and have certainty on. I mean, that's the only point.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your concern. I'm hoping you can work with Wayne. I just want to make a note for the committee and for the record that we recently passed a bill that had third-party registration. That was a fuel cell bill, and so we often do look at third-party registration. That my understanding is US EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is actually, I don't know if approved is the word, or sanctioned, or, you know, blessed these standards. So I think that they are being worked with the federal government, with oversight of the federal government, and maybe we'll need to make sure that that's clear in this statute.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And actually, I just put in a plug for Free Geek, so I might as well bring them up. Allison Briggs and Sean First would like to come testify. I really do bring my computers to you.
That's
so.
What I heard, actually.
Yes.
Hey, guys. My name is Sean First. I'm Volunteer Program Coordinator and Outreach Coordinator at Free Geek.
And my name is Allison Briggs, and I'm the Volunteer Coordinator and Trainer. And I wanted to thank everyone here for the opportunity for us to be involved in the legislative process, because this is both our first times ever being involved in something like
welcome.
This.
Welcome. Thanks for coming all the way to Salem today.
As many of you may know, Free Geek is a not-for-profit community organization that recycles used technology to provide computers education, internet access, and job skills training to those in need in exchange for community service. As of the fourth quarter of 2006, this unique and highly successful model has resulted in over 54,000 hours of time volunteered at our organization. On any given day, as many as 100 volunteers may contribute their time towards earning a free computer. In the 7 years since its inception, Free Geek has recycled over 1,500 tons of e-waste. 1,000 tons of this waste were recycled in the past 2 years alone. For this reason, Free Geek supports legislation which endeavors to minimize the harmful impact of electronic waste on the environment, and I sincerely applaud the efforts that you have made towards refining this legislation and taking everyone's considerations into account. Free Geek turns one person's trash into another's treasure by refurbishing cast-off computer equipment and recirculating it within the community to both individuals and to organizations, such as nonprofits, who would otherwise not have the means to bridge the digital divide. In 2000, Free Geek received 20,000 computer systems, and approximately a quarter of those were given away to volunteers and nonprofits. And this is only about 5% of the consumer waste stream from the Portland metro area, and the success of our organization testifies to the fact that there is a great need for reused computers in our community. While Free Geek also recycles the technology determined to be obsolete, even our responsible disposal has environmental and social costs. Older hardware is often reusable, and the techniques developed by Free Geek to maximize the reuse of this hardware should not be devalued. I'd like to thank you all for the inclusion of Section 2 in the amendments of Section 2, Subsection D5, which defines environmentally sound management practices as those which include provisions for reuse and refurbishment. And one suggestion that we thought we might have is perhaps to lower manufacturing fees in relation to the percent that those items are reused, and perhaps this would encourage manufacturers to seek out those who do reuse simply recycling. And we would like to see more emphasis on reuse in this bill, very similar to what Lorraine Kurwitz said. So Free Geek also supports Section 10.5 of the amendments, which confers responsibility on the DEQ for establishing a state contractor program which uses existing local collection and recycling infrastructure. Since about a quarter of our income comes from monitor drop-off fees, the welfare of our organization depends on adequate and efficient reimbursement for our reuse and recycling services. Additionally, Free Geek strongly supports transparency of methodology in the entire process. In section 10.3, we would suggest including on the DEQ website where the covered products go every step of the way after collection. And because we want to ensure that end processors are truly operating in an environmentally responsible fashion. FreeGeek seeks out partners who engage in these responsible practices and has found that good intentions are not always fulfilled. So certification of recyclers and transparency of methodology are essential in order to ensure the state's approved processors do not take hazardous shortcuts in their methodology. Improper disposal of hazardous electronic waste currently causes enormous environmental and public health problems both locally and worldwide. Third world countries can earn money by importing American e-waste but are generally ill-equipped to dispose of it properly. Section 2, subsection D5, calls for the adequate record keeping, and FreeGeek wishes to emphasize the importance of this in protecting the health of all Oregonians. And we encourage all who are curious about FreeGeek's operations to visit us up in Portland. We would be very happy to show off what it is that we do and give you a special tour. So thank you for our time and listening to our statement and for having us here today.
Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. And for a first time testifying in front of committee, you did a fabulous job. So we really appreciate your comments. And I think a tour would be a very good idea because I'm not sure if many folks up here have toured a recycling facility. I know I have, and I also used to have Strut in students recycling used technology in my district before it shut down due to lack of funding.
Yeah, they did a good job, too. Yeah. So they did cool work.
Madam Chair, a comment and then a question. Also, thank you, and thank you to FreeGeek. I'm a teacher, and one of my eighth-grade students spent part of his last spring volunteering at FreeGeek. He collected e-waste at school and brought it in. It's almost, shouldn't call it e-waste, because it was being reused. And he brought it in, able to rebuild it, and he got great mentoring from the folks at, and that's what I appreciated most as a teacher, was the kind of adult relationships that he formed there with some of the folks that he met. So I really appreciate that. My question for you is whether you have any sense of what a participation in a program like this might mean for FreeGeek in terms of, building the organization financially, et cetera. Do you have any sense of that?
I think, like Ali said here, we get 25% of our income from our monitor fees. And those monitor fees would be taken away by this bill, which is fine with us because it's encouraging recycling all around. We just need to make sure that we can make that money so that we can survive. I think one of the other biggest ways that it's going to affect us is that we have to keep track of brands, and that might require us to get more space and therefore pay more rent for our recycling operation so we can subdivide everything by brand. I think that might be the biggest effects that we've seen.
I just point out, using the California reimbursement rate of 20 cents per pound, and I have no idea what it will be here and whether that might be quite different, but using that rate, your 1,000 tons would be $200,000.
Well, that's, but it's different for covered.
It's
like we take,
yeah, they take
all
sure.
electronics,
right?
Sure.
So it's only for covered electronics.
But it would be systems, laptops, monitors,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually the bulk. Like last year we recycled 500 tons.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 cents per pound and maybe say 400 tons or something are covered.
And the ratings in Washington, I think, is 50 cents.
Yeah,
I don't know why there's such disparity, but I think it's 50 cents in Washington.
So who can do the quick math? 400 tons equals...
Don't look at us. We're just legislators.
I know.
We just fell into the budget.
I actually think you get to 200,000 again that
yeah,
way.
200,000, so, yeah.
But
yes, that would be...
No, it's just interesting to think about as your mm-hmm. organization moves forward under this, assuming it passes.
Yeah, thanks for those numbers, too.
Mm-hmm.
It would definitely be a concerted effort on our part to restructure our organization a bit to make sure that we could withstand all of these, like Sean said, moving everything around so that we made sure that each brand was accounted for.
Well, not just withstand, but encourage it. Like,
yeah.
This is something that we want to.
Yeah.
So.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much for coming here today. And
thanks a lot.
Appreciate your testimony. Okay, I'm going to, is there anybody else that would like to come up to testify that hasn't signed up before I call the Department of Environmental Quality back up? Okay.
Well, Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Danko, Department of Environmental Quality. I just want to briefly discuss what Julie Brandis mentioned about the retailers and about the enforcement and penalty section of the bill. I'm passing out just the policy section of our Division 12, which is the department's enforcement procedure and civil penalties. I won't go into detail, but the way we handle something like this, we've developed these administrative rules in a very transparent process with enormous stakeholder involvement. When it says a penalty up to $10,000, that is a maximum. When you go through the rules that we have, in the end, you get to a point where putting a written form into a along with the sales for the retailers of the covered devices, you get to a place where that'll be likely a Class 3 violation. Mm-hmm. Class 3 violations, when you go through this procedure, results at most usually warning letters, and there's very little history of Class 3 violations by themselves being issued civil penalties. So the $10,000 a day, which applies to all of the violations of solid waste rules, quickly lessons as you go through this enforcement procedure, which is an administrative rule.
Okay, Bob, thank you. Do you, and unfortunately I had to step out for a minute, but do you want to comment at all on the, Julie Brandis also had, I guess, some concern about the second shall and being more specific about the materials for the, I think it was the internet versus printed, and I don't know if you have any.
I met with her earlier today, and I think as we implement the bill, I think the language is fine, and I think that part of her concern was the point of sale versus actual delivery of the product, and I think that's something that through procedures we can work on. So I don't think that is a particular problem.
Okay. Any other questions?
I do have a couple of questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you talk about what role you imagine reuse organizations playing in the, say, the contractor program, the DEQ-sponsored program? We've heard from Mr. Jones and Ms. Kerwood that they'd like to ensure, and Free Geek would concur, they'd like to ensure that, you know, reuse has a role to play in whatever sort of state program is administered. Can you talk about how you envision that under the statute, the proposed statute in front of us?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, that is very difficult to address in law. Mandatory reuse or how you deal with refurbishment and so on. We put it in there in the environmental practices section, recognizing that, yes, indeed, it's an important part of this whole picture. Maybe not necessarily exactly what's in the law, but of the whole picture of how we deal with electronic devices. But when I, you know, just my own picture of how Free Geek is going to operate is if they are a collector in the contractor program, lots of material, probably a lot more material will go to them than what is going to them now if they want it. Because, again, it's going to be free and convenient, and so their costs of managing that material after they're done with it is going to be covered. So the material going to them will be more significant, and then they will be able to decide what they can reuse, what they can refurbish, and then what they can't, of course, is where the contractor program will take it off their hands, so they don't, so they don't have any costs in managing that. So I just see this as a boon for a business like Free Geek. I think because of the publicity, because of taking the material off their hands, that right now they have to charge the public and pay a cost to manage, taking that off their hands, I think it's really going to really give them lots of support. The more material that goes to them, the more material that's going to be available for them to reuse and refurbish.
Follow up, would that also be the case for, we heard from Next Step as well as the Apple reuser, similar category?
Yeah, I don't think Free Geek's unique in that situation.
Okay.
Another follow-up?
I guess, one, again on that point, will they actually be required to sort under this law, or do you come in and do the sampling?
The way the language is, it provides almost an options approach. Some may want to sort. Some may want to count. But really, what we talked about is using sampling according to a certain methodology that makes sure we get relatively accurate numbers. So they won't necessarily have to sort, but some may want to do that.
The wording
in the bill in a couple places is sample according to a methodology or count.
Right. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is from 2 days ago. We are being handed out written testimony from Total Reclaim committee members that they testified on Wednesday on this bill, and I'm just assuming this is their testimony from that day. Okay, thank you. Bob, before you leave, one last question, because you're not available next week, so I want to make sure and get this on the record. Can you just, because we had a lot of discussion in the work group about environmentally sound management practices, so for the committee members and for the audience members here, and since it was brought up by the women from Free Geek, if you could sort of talk a little bit about that, and you do have rulemaking authority in here for that. And maybe you can explain for the committee how, what standards are currently in place or not at the state and federal level and what this legislation intends to do.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm not an expert on this, and maybe other people in the audience have more knowledge. Right now, there's discussions at the federal level that have been going on for some time to have the stakeholders involved agree upon environmental management practices and standards. And so we anticipate at some point that's going to be agreed upon, and there's going to be a national approach to look at this at the environmentally sound practices part. And I think that's going to be very important because it's very difficult for a particular state to impact exactly what's going on, especially when waste leaves the state. So it's difficult to do it state by state. But in the meantime, of course, we don't want to just remain silent and hope the feds have an approach that works for everybody. So what we've tried to do in this bill is to address it in a way that allows us in the contractor program and allows manufacturers, if they do their own plans, to have to speak to those areas, and we've listed some of the areas in the definition. And it also allows the Environmental Quality Commission to address this area by rule. And if we don't get the consensus approach at the federal level, we will do that by rule. So while it's not hard and fast, I think the intent's clear, the language is there, and I think over time we're going to get there. Now, there is an important area that isn't covered in the bill that I think some of the speakers have mentioned and some of the testimony has referenced, and that is the standards for processors that are not part of the manufacturer program or the contractor program in this bill. In other words, there could be processors out there, and there could be collectors out there that really aren't part of this bill. They're out there now. And they may not be part of this bill. And really, there's nothing that really addresses that. And, we've talked about how big business has their own processes. They don't fall under this bill and so on. And that material still goes somewhere. Now, it's likely that the people involved with this bill also will capture much of that other market, but not exclusively. So there's been, some testimony saying that we, as a state, should have processing standards, environmental sound practice standards applying to everybody in the business, not just those that fall under this bill. Right now, that's not included in this bill, and that is, I think, another major step. Maybe that is something we should talk about during the interim and come back next session and think about how to do that for everybody.
Okay. And, Bob, just to clarify, how do you currently regulate or not recycling, current recycling facilities that are you know, working on computers or other materials.
Madam Chair, it's more of the or not, unless they cross over into the hazardous waste regulations, of course, which we regulate. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't regulate, you know, recycling businesses like that.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions from the committee?
I guess just a final question also, since we won't have you on Monday. If we get an amendment from the TV manufacturers that looks the way the proposed amendment from the TV manufacturers looks, is that going to work for DEQ?
There's a lot of if we do.
Yes, well, I'm assuming we will get an amendment from the TV manufacturers and it will look like the one that you've seen.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, we have worked with the television manufacturers and we believe we have reached consensus on language that accomplishes their objective to the way they would pay the recycling fee under the bill. And, yes, we think it's workable and we would be fine with it.
Thank you, Bob. Okay. Well, with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2626, the dash twos, and I will close the Energy and Environment Committee and see you all on Monday. It is posted for a work session Monday and Wednesday, depending on the timing of the amendments.